So, two police officers turned up at a house where there'd been shots fired, and the wife had just shot the husband, and because he'd walked across the floor, which had just recently been mopped. And they phoned the sergeant back at the base and said, "Looks like we've got a homicide, sir." And he says, "Well, what happened?" Says, "Well, the wife shot the husband because he walked across the wet floor." And he said, "Well, have you put her under arrest?" And they say, "No, we haven't." And he says, "Why is that?" Says, "Well, the floor's still wet." Where do I get them from? Well, you know where I get them from. Cousin Brian. Families, families. Some are absolutely fantastic and they're all that they should be, and some just don't quite make it, and some are a real mixture. So we're going to be looking at families and David's family affairs, as it were, tonight. King David. We've been tracking through the life of King David over the weeks, and great leader, great warrior, unifier of the nation. Family, wah, wah, not so good. But first, before we get into that, a couple of quotes that I came across this week. One is a chap called Michael Schluter, who runs the Jubilee Centre in Cambridge. And he's really into what he calls relational thinking, which is based on Jesus' command to love God and neighbour. And he says, "This is what God wants most from individuals and families, and even multinationals and nations. In God's eyes," he said, "a developed country was not necessarily one with a high GDP, but one with healthy relationships in the family, community, business, church, and public square." By that criteria, he proposed, many Western nations with high divorce rates, broken families, lonely neighbours, and old people could still be considered underdeveloped. Europeans face major challenges stemming from the dominant cult of individualism in society, maximising the freedom of choice for each individual rather than a choice for the welfare of others. Kind of broad strokes there. But then there's another one. This is a statistic, UK statistic. The cost of family breakdown to the country has shot up by more than £10 billion each year since 2009, a study found. It put the price to taxpayers in 2015 of clearing up the damage after families fail and looking after the separated adults and children at £47.31 billion. The bill takes in the cost of benefits, health and social care, housing, policing and the courts, and the price of failure in the education system of children hurt by divorce or the parting of their parents. The Relationships Foundation think tank said that the money spent because of family breakdown amounts to 3% of the economic product of the country. And each taxpayer, when you divide that out, will have to contribute £1,546. Well, that's a mess, isn't it? Let's look at another mess. And I realise that talking about this, and in a sense in this manner, at one level it's kind of out here, but another level it's in here, because some of us have come from difficult families. Some of us are part of difficult families. And there's no sense of blame about this, but we want to look at the issue honestly and see what we can find and see whether we can dig out some encouragement from it all. So if you want to look in the Bible, we're looking at 2 Samuel chapter 13. Well, in fact, 2 Samuel 15. We've got about 5 chapters to read through tonight, so I decided we're not going to read them through. I think that was a good decision. But if we look at 2 Samuel 15, verse 30. I couldn't find it myself yet. 2 Samuel 15, verse 30. It's on page 320. And it's one verse that illustrates a lot. Page 320, second column, halfway down. But David continued up the Mount of Olives, weeping as he went. His head was covered, and he was barefoot. All the people with him covered their heads too, and were weeping as they went up. This was a long and lonely road. He was going up the Mount of Olives just outside of Jerusalem. He was fleeing, and he was fleeing. We'll find out what the backstory is in a minute. But this is King David. This is King David who defeated Goliath. This is King David who, wherever he seemed to go, had victory and defeated nations. Here, in later life, he's fleeing, and he's fleeing for this particular backstory. If you turn back a couple of chapters to chapter 13, page 316, chapter 13, verse 1. In the course of time, Amnon, son of David, fell in love with Tamar, the beautiful sister of Absalom, son of David. So Amnon was a son of David, Absalom was a son of David, different mothers, and Tamar was Amnon's half-sister. It says he fell in love with her, but actually he fell in lust with her. The passions were strong, he couldn't control himself, he really wanted to have her, but he couldn't and she wasn't interested. And so he with a friend develops a ruse, it's all in this chapter, where he would feign illness, and he would go to bed and he would ask his half-sister, Tamar, to come and to feed him. And so they do that, and Amnon's there pretending to be ill. Tamar comes in, and he rapes her. Verse 12. My brother, she said to him, don't force me. Such a thing should not be done in Israel. Don't do this wicked thing. What about me? Where can I get rid of my disgrace? And what about you? You'll be like one of the wicked fools in Israel. Please speak to the king, and he'll not keep me from being married to you. But he refused to listen to her, and since he was stronger than she, he raped her. And then an amazing switch of affections, the next verse. Then Amnon hated her with intense hatred. In fact, he hated her more than he had loved her. Amnon said to her, get up and get out. Horrible event. The Bible is pretty lurid in what it describes at times, isn't it? A rape. And so she flees. David hears about it, and he is extremely angry, but he doesn't do anything more than that. He's just angry, as he would be. But Absalom is Tamar's brother, and he says to her, well, you come and live in my house, and I'll look after you. Tamar actually needed a dad to look after her at that point, but actually it was her brother that looked after him. So there she was. She stayed with him 2 years. Absalom was fuming. And what happens over the next chapter is that Absalom, 2 years pass, and Absalom's anger is just stored up and stored up. And he finally decides, I'm going to kill my half-brother, Amnon. So he does that. Again, he sets things up, the kind of festival, harvest festival, and invites Amnon along, get him drunk, and then he tells his own men to kill him. So that's what happened. So we've got rape, we've got incest. It's a terrible list, this. Rape, incest, murder, drunkenness, and all of that is going on in King David's family. Not exactly the best of families, is it? the home that I grew up in, I come from, thankfully, a really, I don't want to say we're sorted in every respect, but a pretty stable family. My parents loved each other and they loved us three children. Next door, family of four, it was just a mess. And I remember actually seeing and being frightened as a young boy of fist fights on the front lawn between the father and one of the older sons. It's a really ugly thing to see. Families. David's family had got into a mess. Absalom is banished for 3 years. And then gradually, through a process, he ends up coming back to Jerusalem, and then eventually he comes back into the into connection with King David, his father. And what happens subsequent to that? Well, Absalom, it's too late, really. Absalom has now, he's obviously a mature man, and he has aspirations on the throne, and basically he stages a coup. to dethrone David, his father, and it's all set up, and the military forces are mobilized. David doesn't think he can win, so Absalom has men out looking for David, his father, and want to possibly to kill him. And then we come back to that verse which we read at the start, which was David fleeing, verse 30, but David continued up the Mount of Olives, weeping as he went. His head was covered and he was barefoot. This has to be one of David's worst moments in life. His family had messed up. I think there were probably two questions that if they'd been asked of King David, he would have struggled with. And the first question is, David, how are your kids? How are your kids? And he'd have just groaned. He'd have been a kind of Homer Simpson figure, I think. He'd have just, it's a mess. It's a mess. And we can see that in what we've read, and we can see that further in what happens subsequently. In fact, there's another of David's sons later stages, a coup as well, to try and gain the throne. So these are David's sons and daughter, and there's all sorts of stuff going on. And this is, you know, a family that is just struggling. As I was thinking, you know, this is the kind of underneath side. This is the dark side of King David. You know, this is the great psalmist, the great man who kind of fought battles and won them, and who knew God and trusted God, who wrote Psalm 23 and many other psalms and so on. He had great faith in God. But yet in this part of his life, he was toiling. He was not dealing with the issues. So Max Lucado, whose book we've been following, he says this about David. He says, going AWOL in his family was David's greatest failure. Seducing Bathsheba was an inexcusable but explicable act of passion. Murdering Uriah was a ruthless yet predictable deed from a desperate heart. But passive parenting and widespread philandering, these were not sins of a slothful afternoon or the deranged reactions of self-defense. David's family foul-up was a lifelong stupor that cost him dearly. He'd been too busy. It had been too important, the other stuff that he'd been doing. He'd been too guilty with his own failure with Bathsheba, and now it was too late. He'd left a trail of sons who actually needed a dad, and he wasn't there. He possibly had the attitude, mothers can do that stuff. The mothers can bring the kids up. But I'm the soldier, and I'm the leader, and I've got far more important stuff to do. So when we become Christians, when Christ comes into our lives, that, you know, what goes on, there's the most powerful change agent comes to our lives. We begin to change. Our lives begin to be refashioned. Our priorities begin to change. But one of the saddest things is that when, you know, there's Christians who ought to know better do something that's wrong. And it's, I kind of have this phrase in my head. There's bits of our lives that aren't yet converted. There's, you know, a relationship here or an attitude there or the way we handle our money or whatever it is, whether it's sex, that, you know, it's kind of like there's a bit of us which has not yet come under the rule of Christ. But the possibility is that having become Christians, we really can change. We really can be different. We have the change agent of the Holy Spirit living within us, and change happens in our lives. So that's why it's so sad about David. That's why it's so sad. So good in so many other aspects of his life. But in this area, he was a mess. Claire's told me not to give David too hard a time because he's one of her great favourites in the Bible. How am I doing so far, dear? Pretty bad, I think. What I want to say is, okay, some of us are parents or have been parents. Some of us are not parents or not yet parents. So some of this stuff you just need to kind of put in the filing system and maybe hold for later on. And it does include mothers as well as fathers, but we're concentrating on fathers. I've got four tips. And you can ask Claire whether or not I have been good at these. I'm not going to do self-confession at the moment. But tip number one, when you become a father, or if you are a father, then time with your kids. Spend time with your kids. Learn to spend time with them. Had David done that, things would probably have been different. This, of course, is next to loving them. You know, the overall thing is to love your children. But just a little practical tip is spend time with them. Just, you know, do something extra. Listen out for them. Go for a walk with them, whatever it is. Go play a game with them, etc., etc. Spend time with them. That's the first thing. Second tip is affirm. Affirm them. Encourage them. Encourage them. I know my father, who was not a perfect father, but my father, I can't think of any time when he discouraged me. You know, it was just, he kind of poured encouragement into my life. And I don't know about you, but when somebody encourages you, when somebody says to you, you know, you did that really well, or, you know, whatever it is, that's, you're looking really good today, or just, yeah, I was really impressed with such and such. When somebody says that to you, what does it do to you on the inside? You say, oh, really? It just kind of lifts something from you. Because so often we discourage ourselves, don't we? We kind of hammer ourselves down. But when somebody encourages us and affirms us, it just kind of does something to us. And as fathers, as parents, to encourage your children is just one of the best things you can do. A third tip, negatively, is don't exasperate them. Paul says this in one of his letters. He says, fathers, do not exasperate your children. Don't make them resentful or angry. You know, you have power over them. You're stronger than them. But don't treat them in a way that puts them down and makes them exasperated or resentful of you. Because the thing is, they will grow up. And you might not be the strongest then, and you may not be able to control them. So, fathers, do not exasperate your children, Paul says. Don't give them a hard time. Sure, discipline and strong boundaries and so on, but don't exasperate your children. And my fourth tip, there could be a long, long list, and this isn't the place for that. My fourth tip is pray for your children. Again, some of you have not got children yet. Chances are you're going to. But pray for your children. I realized early on when I became a dad, we had twins for starters, so that was a challenge. But I realized I was just totally unprepared as a father. And I thought, help, help. This is a huge challenge to me. And I thought, well, I don't know how it's going to work out, you know, when they're 5 years old, 10 years old, 13 years old, whatever. But I sure want it to work out well for them. And I decided early on that I would pray for them. So when they were just little kids in their cots, Ruth and David, I would actually, you know, I'd just go in last thing at night if I hadn't been involved in getting them into bed. And I'd place my hand on their head and I'd pray for them, pray for Ruth and pray for David. Every night, do that. And then Nathan came along, and then Catherine came along, and I just did the same. And then they grew up, and they vacated beds and went off to university or whatever it was. But I still do it, actually, almost every night still. I call it my ward round, actually. So, you know, I just go into their rooms, or what was their rooms, or I kind of put them in rooms, and I have my ward round. I just say a brief prayer over each of my kids. That's my tip. I'm not a perfect father, but that's my tip. Pray for your kids. Pray for your kids. So there's four tips. So that was the first question of David. How are your kids? He'd have groaned. Second question, which would have given him a hard time, would be, how's your marriage? He'd have said, which one? He had loads of wives. Turn to 2 Samuel 3, verse 2. Which is a few pages back. So verse 2, sons were born to David in Hebron. His firstborn was Amnon, who raped. He was the son of Ahinoam of Jezreel. Why do I choose long lists of names to read when I'm speaking? This is crazy, isn't it? Everyone have a go. His firstborn was Amnon, son of Ahinoam of Jezreel. His second, Kileab, the son of Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel. The third, Absalom, the son of Maachah, daughter of Talmai, king of Geshur. The fourth, Adonijah, son of Haggith. The fifth, Shephatiah, the son of Abital. And the sixth, Itream, the son of David's wife, Eglah. These were born to David in Hebron. I count six wives there. Throw in Bathsheba, which was his affair. She eventually married her. Throw in Michael, who was his first wife, the daughter of Saul. That's eight wives. And he had concubines. What's a concubine? It's a woman who is less than wife in terms of social status, part of the household, and probably there for sexual gratification. So, David, whoa, what did you do with what God says at the beginning of creation? He says about, you know, for this cause a man will leave his mother and father and be united to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. One man, one woman. One man, one woman. But he said, yeah, but it's a culture, you know, it's a kind of position of status. We've all got lots of wives. All the big men have got lots of wives. The culture was wrong. The culture messed up, and it messed up people's lives. So when David said, if asked figuratively, how is your marriage? He'd have said, well, which one? And actually, they're not all that good. How can you spend time, any kind of quality time, with eight wives plus concubines? Relationship, it's just not going to work. So, but that was his culture. Now, I doubt that any of us are going to get into quite that kind of state in our lives, having lots of wives. But I was saying that their culture was wrong, and I think there's some things in which our culture is wrong too. And I think, you know, Western society is getting messed up with our attitude to sex and our attitude to family and our attitude to marriage. And again, this could be a whole long day's seminar almost, and I'm not the kind of person to say this. But I think we're messing up in this area. I think the kind of the ease of which people have sex today, you like somebody, you have sex, and then maybe you cohabit, and then maybe you get married. That's the kind of process. That's kind of like our culture today. That's on the media, it's on the films. Sex comes first. Well, maybe a bit of relationship, then sex, and then you see where it goes. That's our culture. And I want to shout and say, no! Our culture's wrong. We're messing up. And we're experiencing the consequences in our society of messed up culture. A word about cohabiting. I've got to be in the bonnet about this. You know, some people think it's really okay. You know, if you love somebody, then, well, let's just, you know, we won't get married, but we'll cohabit. And we'll live together. Because that way we'll get out of all the kind of expense of a marriage, and if things don't work out, we can separate easily and so on. And I just want to say, look, if you're cohabiting, you're married. That is marriage. You know, Paul says in Corinthians about, you know, if you're joined even to a prostitute, you become one flesh. You become one flesh. It's almost like if you have sex with somebody, then you're married. So you don't escape divorce by cohabiting and then giving the freedom to separate subsequently. Actually, you go through divorce. It's just that there's no bits of paper, either at the beginning or the end, but you go through all the kind of tearing apart of the relationship and the consequences. Somebody we know, just this week, has been cohabiting with somebody for 2-3 years, I forget how long now. Looked like a good relationship to start with, but actually it's gone sour and they're separating, and it is extremely painful. They're going through divorce. They weren't married with a piece of paper, and they're not divorcing with a piece of paper, but they have been cohabiting, they've been living together, they have been as married, and they're going through the pain now of that. It is extremely painful. Survey. You don't know quite how much to, and there's all sorts of exceptions with these surveys, but an official survey of well-being found that married people have a much higher chance of happiness than those who live together in cohabiting relationships. Statistic being found in our society today. And it also says cohabitees are 3 to 4 times more likely to separate than married couples. So if you cohabit, you kind of, and you stay together, then you're kind of going against the statistics, because you're 3 or 4 times more likely to separate if you cohabit. So somehow or other, what God said about, you know, marriage, it seems to work. It seems to work for us as people, and it seems to work for society. And it, and if we think we can do it differently, if our society thinks we're doing it differently, you want to say, no, we've got it wrong. You know, let's do it right. Let's do it God's ways. How's your marriage, David? He was struggling. So 4 tips. Next to loving your wife, which is the overall, overarching. First of all, and again, you can ask Claire on this one, how good I've been at this. it's very dangerous speaking about this subject. Tip number one is learn to say sorry. Learn to say sorry. Every relationship needs to be able to say sorry. So we need to get good at saying sorry. Actually, as Christians, we need to get good at saying sorry. So I think we should just have a little practice now. So say with me, on the count of 3, the word sorry. 1, 2, 3. Sorry. That wasn't so hard, was it? That was okay, wasn't it? Well, get good at that. Get good at that. When you've offended somebody or when there's been an issue, just, you know, you say sorry. You be the first to say sorry. Secondly, learn to forgive. Learn to forgive, because you'll need that in an enduring relationship. C.S. Lewis says, everybody thinks forgiveness is a great idea until they've got something to forgive, which is true. But they were really irritated me. That was really annoying, etc., etc. But our response, because of the change agent of the Holy Spirit within us, is to forgive. We can forgive. It is possible. Give forgiveness. So learn to forgive. Learn to say sorry. Learn to forgive. 3, same with children, encourage. 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 I personally cannot get enough encouragement. You know, I need people to say to me, that was all right, that was good, etc. Because without that, I'm a kind of mess on the inside. So in marriage, you know, encourage and encourage and encourage. And see what that does to the relationship. And fourthly, be the person. This is to the guys. Be the person that she would like to live with. Deal with the bad habits. Does it really cost your manhood all that much to put the toilet seat down after you've done a wee? Be the person that she wants to live with. And likewise, women, you know, be the person that he wants to live with. It's a matter of giving and connecting and relating. So there's my 4 tips. There should be a lot more, but time won't allow. So how are your kids? How are your family? How was your marriage? David would not have scored all that high in those departments. But I want to say, just as I come towards the end, David had another son, and he's not been listed there. And the son came a lot later, a lot later. But he was called the son of David. And he did some amazing things, actually. He did some remarkable things. And this is what somebody writes about this other son. We look at this son and see the God who cannot be seen. We look at this son and see God's original purpose in everything created. For everything, absolutely everything, above and below, visible and invisible, rank after rank of angels, everything got started in him and finds its purpose in him. He was there before any of it came into existence and holds it all together right up to this moment. And when it comes to the church, he organizes it and holds it together like a head does a body. He was supreme in the beginning, and leading the resurrection parade, he's supreme in the end. From beginning to end, he's there, towering far above everything, everyone. So spacious is he, so roomy that everything of God finds its proper place in him without crowding. Not only that, but all the broken and dislocated pieces of the universe, people and things, animals and atoms, get properly fixed and fit together in vibrant harmonies, all because of his death, his blood that poured down from the cross. All the broken and dislocated pieces of the universe, people, things, I'm going to put in families there, animals and atoms, get properly fixed and fit together in vibrant harmonies, all because of his death, his blood that poured down from the cross. What's the name of that son of David? It's Jesus. John and Lindsay, come and pray for us.